to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 760. My name is Camden Busey, and I am in Libertyville, Illinois. Got a fun one today. We're actually live streaming on YouTube. We don't do that very often. We're looking to do this perhaps a little bit more often, but it's a very special day to be broadcasting live, and we've got a fun kind of free-flowing conversation lined up. We're going to nerd out a little bit with none other than Dr. Benjamin Glad. Dr. Ben Glad is a professor of New Testament at RTS Jackson. And of course, he's been a guest on our program several times as the author of many books and articles. Welcome, Ben. It's glad to see you. I'm glad to see you. Welcome.
Oh. It's so good to be here. Thanks for chatting with me.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate you being able and willing to do this. We're going to be talking today about research and writing methods and tools, getting into the weeds of researching and doing exegesis in the Bible, of taking notes, of perhaps organizing those notes, documenting sources, and turning all these things into articles and books, however it may go. So once in a while, it's nice to kind of revisit our paths or our processes. And I always like to hear other people describing the ways in which they work, because it helps me understand, you know, whether I'm doing something most efficiently or finding a better way to do it. And that is highly subjective, of course, but there are some better ways to do it than others. So we'll get into that in a minute, but I want to mention a few things first. Head on over to reformedforum.org. our website, for information about everything we have going on. Perhaps the biggest news is we have two in-person events coming up very soon. So August 12th and 13th, a Friday night and a Saturday morning, Mark Winder will be teaching a course on Zephaniah. You can register for that on our website at reformedforum.org. That's going to be targeted towards an adult Sunday school level. His material on Zephaniah is very rich in Old Testament biblical theology, some things that you'd appreciate, Ben. And of course, Dr. Beale and others we've had on the program would very much like the ways in which he's treating that minor prophet. And September 30th and October 1st, we're having our annual theology conference. We'll be back at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. So it's just about, 25 minutes away from O'Hare, pretty easy to get here. And we'll be focusing on the life and works of Meredith G. Klein. Also some connections here in terms of Old Testament biblical theology and whatnot. This year would mark the 100th birthday of Klein if he would have lived to the date. So we're going to celebrate his life and his works. And we're going to have Danny Olinger, John Meether from RTS, there you go, as well as Lane Tipton and Scott Wright speaking about Meredith Klein. So it should be an exciting time. All of the information for these events, as well as links to register, are online at reformedforum.org, and you'll find it under the events tab. So I want to promote that and let people know about it. We hope to see you either in August or in October or both. A lot of fun stuff coming up. Ben, what's going on at RTS? Why don't you give us an update, if you don't mind? I mean, it's the summertime, but are you gearing up and getting prepared for another semester?
Yeah, so I'm right in the midst of teaching summer Greek.
Oh, okay.
We started second semester Greek today. We learned about the aorist passive and the future passives. These are life-changing tenses and voices. We've had conversions actually in these classes.
Yeah.
No, this is great. I love teaching summer Greek. I love getting to know the students and learning from them. I will then take this course and we'll go right into Greek exegesis in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so we learn the basics of Greek here. And then in the fall, we learn how to use Greek. I tell my students that just because you know Greek well doesn't mean that you are a good exegete. In fact, Sure. Just look at Erasmus. The guy had an amazing grasp of Greek and in the language and morphology, and yet fell short, in my opinion, of being a good theologian. On the other hand, you had a guy like Augustine, mm-hmm. right, who regrettably did not know the language as well, barely knew Hebrew, and yet look at his, he's an amazing theologian. And so the idea then is to learn Greek and learn Hebrew well so that you can become an exegete. Greek and Hebrew can only take you so far. You've got to know how to use these languages well. And that's what we do here. And that's what I'm going to do in the fall. Is I'm going to show these students how to use Greek in the process of exegesis for the glory of God.
Amen. So do you have either maybe 8 or 9 credit hours for the typical MDiv that go towards Greek? Is it broken up into 3 courses or is it?
Yeah, so it's 2 Greek, 2 summer Greek, that's six hours.
Sure.
And then 2 more for Greek exegesis, that's a total of 8. And then they can take electives and on top of that. So I do 1 Peter in Greek, Colossians in Greek, Mark in Greek. Mm-hmm. Guy Waters does portions of Romans in Greek. Then they take Greek and they apply it in the survey courses as well.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, of course. Very good. That's exciting. So hopefully some of the things we learned today are things that your students are doing and
we'll talk about this.
You're teaching and expressing to them. I think you're an excellent, perhaps the perfect person to talk about some of these things because you do a ton of work in academics. You're prolific from one perspective in terms of actually producing. A lot of people fiddle around and read, but you actually get things done. So pulling the curtain back. And,
I probably should read more.
Well, we all should, right? But I mean, pulling the curtain back and thinking of what it takes to ship things, to get things out the door, to have something that's publishable in the first place, but then also to publish it, whether those be journal articles or books or volumes that you're editing, whatever it may be. There's a lot of steps that go on into that. So hopefully we can talk about some of this stuff. So I see you're sharing your screen. Maybe we can start off with just some of the basics. I'm curious about what you do in terms of studying the Bible. What tools do you use and what's your general practice?
Right. Well, let me start. I was thinking about this morning and I kind of came up with some notes for today.
First of all,
please, so as I work through portions of this, let me know, hey, this is really good, or let's keep moving, or let's stop, or
you got it,
or please feel free to interject and I'll ask you questions as well. Let's start here. And by the way, I'm just really excited about this because I really get to talk about this particular aspect of the process, and just like you, there's a lot that goes on in the background. And Camden, these are things that are not taught to students.
I know.
Rarely do professors and mentors coach students in these areas. So I wish I had it. And to be fair, my doctoral father, he did a very good job in this. But again, everybody does things differently, and it really goes back to how do you learn. It's tied to our personalities, tied to how God made us. So this is what works for me. What works for me may work for you. It may not work for other people. But over the years, this is the method that I've kind of come up with. The first thing, and this is probably one of the most difficult, and that is just how do you collect data? So when a publisher approaches me or I approach a publisher and I say, hey, I want to do this project, the project is, I typically like to just do projects that are more on the commentary, more on the Bible side of things. I rarely do topical pieces. For example, like I did a piece in this Covenant volume that Crossway put together. Guy Waters asked me to do an essay on the New Perspective and Covenant. And so that's more just learning secondary literature and seeing how scholars interact with themes or text. So that requires tons of reading. So with that type of thing, I will have to take a couple weeks out and just read and read and read and read and process and start to assemble, start to organize. Most of the time, the stuff that I'm asked to do or that I ask publishers to do is more of just, I'm working with text and I'm explaining text. I'm explaining how texts are put together. I start writing immediately, honestly. It may be a couple hours, maybe a little bit that day I'll start working, but I pretty much just jump right in and I start going. I think I differ from most people in this regard, but I really just get right in and I start writing. Now, it may not be good, and I'm probably going to rewrite those sections.
Oh, yeah.
But I got to get my thoughts down. The more that I start to get my thoughts down, I can go back and I can start to hash and start to hone it up. It's just sort of like working with clay. I've never been a sculptor. I think it would be interesting. So you're working with clay and you just start moving around. And then you can go back and you can kind of keep polishing up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know what you do.
Well, it worked a lot with the Bible and continued to do so, but not as a biblical scholar. So my research process might be a little bit different on some of these things. But I do, when I'm exegeting on a sermon or those sorts of things, my sermon process is a bit different than when I'm just engaging in my typical academic field, which is systematic theology, over the years it's starting to blur or blend more into historical theology. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think the biggest thing is reading. And right. Often if I'm honest with myself, I would prefer just to read. I don't like to do the harder work of documenting what I'm reading, but that's the better way. Everything's better if I spend time reading slowly and recording my thoughts while I'm reading.
How do you record your thoughts?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. So my optimum situation or my optimum process, which is not something I do every time, but I will read slowly. And my tool of choice in the last year or two is an app on Mac called Drafts. And it seems like, why would you need an extra app for this? But when you have this app, you realize how useful it is. It's basically just a text editor, but it allows me to take notes in of a syntax called Markdown. And it, what's neat about it is it just syncs across all my apps and you can dictate into it using Siri or whatever else you're using. So whether I'm on my desktop or my iPad or my phone, I can just throw stuff into Drafts and then categorize it or mess with the text. So if I'm just reading a book, if I'm reading a hard copy book, I might find some things, some segments. Maybe I'll record an excerpt, a block quote of some sort, and I'll record where it came from. I'll document that. I got a lot more to talk about on that if people were interested. And then I will, write my thoughts about it. Basically just process it and what does this mean? And maybe I don't have to have it all figured out. Right. I'm just processing try to put it in my own words. And I find that, oddly enough, I'm writing in that instance, but I think writing is actually a form of thought itself. Right. Writing is not merely the product of thought. It's another mode of thinking if you're going through it. So that's where I start. I get it into text, and then there's this whole other rabbit trail we can go down if we want in a minute. But I use another tool called Obsidian for taking more structured notes. So I'll process what are called literature notes. That's just my ongoing commentary on a book or an article. Mm-hmm. And then I'll process those into what are called in the field, into the Zettelkasten. And so there's this whole subculture of researchers that are into what's called personal knowledge management or PKM. Mm-hmm. Obsidian is a free tool that is really handy at linking notes together. So you can basically kind of think of it as like your own personal Wikipedia where you can link words. So let's say I'm writing on Ned Stonehouse, which I'm doing lately. So whenever I mention Ned Stonehouse, I might put his name in a link. And then over time, I can start to look at my whole catalog of notes, which might have thousands and thousands of notes that I've written over the course of reading hundreds of different books and different times periods when I'm different thought paths and whatnot, but I might start to see that things are interrelated. So it's basically like having a digital card catalog. Back in the older days, people would read for a research topic and then they'd write quotes or thoughts on a note card and they put the source on the other card or on the other side of it and just file it away. Well, imagine if that was digital and you had hyperlinks amongst them all. You can start to realize that you have some budding topics or a network of similar thoughts on a theme that you didn't even really know were there. to begin mm-hmm. with. They just mm-hmm. arise perhaps organically. I guess what we would say, this is more like an inductive way to write a, to come up with a paper topic rather than a deductive way, I suppose. But that's one method, you know. And so basically, I write notes as I read. Later on, I try to process those just flowing, that running commentary into something that is basically like a micro paper. You might think of it as an atom of a paper, like basically a paragraph. And then I'll file that in my Zettelcast, in my notes box, with the appropriate links, either to the work that it came from, to the people I'm talking about, the subjects I'm talking about, that sort of thing. That's the optimal. When I did my conference address from the Reform Forum conference last year, I was writing on Henri de Lubac and mm-hmm. Talking about mm-hmm. nature and grace. And that was probably the first kind of substantial project that was the product of that note-taking process. The book where I get most of this these ideas from is a book by, what's it called? Taking Smart Notes. And I did a whole episode on this on Reform Forum, how to take smart notes if anyone is interested in finding it.
I'm interested.
Yeah, How to Take Smart Notes, One Simple Technique to Boost Writing, Learning, and Thinking for Students, Academics, and Nonfiction Book Writers by a guy named Zünke Ahrens. He's a German. Zünke is S-O-N-K-E with the umlaut over the O, and then Ahrens is A-H-R-E-N-S. So I'll include a link to the book and to the episode in the episode description if people are interested. That might be more than you wanted to bite off and talk
really
about
good.
To begin
That's
with.
Very interesting to see how you work that together. See, I don't do really what you do.
Yeah,
I'm more on the exegesis side of the equation. Right. I'm more of just explaining the text, how the text is built. So,
but you still have to synthesize a lot of thoughts.
Yes, I do.
And for example, if you're reading a commentary that someone else wrote,
right
there, you have to think through what that means, and then finding connections amongst different interpreters. Do you do anything to track your own thought process or to record what you're doing?
Okay, right here.
So hey, look at that.
I just grabbed this. So this is a really good book, Richard Hayes, Reading Backwards. And that's ironically because I am reading this backwards. Like, do you see that? Because my camera, I am reading. So come on, has got to be some kind of like deep meta thought here.
That's only what you see. So we're even getting a third layer deep because it reverses your camera to you, but not to us.
This is amazing. Yeah. This is amazing.
Richard Hayes, Reading Backwards. Why do you like that book?
I wrote a review of it. It's a very good book. There's a lot here, but I want to show you this is just how I work. I keep all of my notes actually in the book. So
that's good. A lot of people do that.
Synthetic. Mm-hmm. These are my notes. As I read through the book, I'm writing my impressions down. And then as the book unfolds, I write summary statements
in the book itself.
I write book itself. So all of my books here, these all contain my notes. I do not keep notes, a file of notes in Word, because I would never, my brain is, I remember that book. I'm going to go pick that book up off my shelf. And then I look back and I go, that's what I remember. Because my brain remembers what page, I don't have a photographic, but I'm like, oh, I remember reading that, and I kind of remember what it looked like.
Yeah, I'm that way too.
And so that's why I keep all my notes actually in the book.
Do you write
a separate file.
The page number in the back? Does your notes in the back serve as kind of like a locator or some sort
synthesis.
Of like...
That's synthesis.
It's a synthesis. But synthesis. You just, do you star something on the page when you're reading?
Right, so I have like the double line. That's very important. So I have my own like the star. The star is a little bit less than a double line. So I have kind of my own way of doing things. Just kind of how I learned over the years.
That's good.
What I like. But this allows, because my brain, this is how I think.
How do you do journal articles if you are stuck with a PDF?
Okay.
Do you print it?
So the other thing, right. So then the other part is, well, what if it's PDF? So when I'm asked to endorse books from time to time, I get maybe one or two a month. Mm-hmm. And that's all PDF, obviously, because it's not hasn't been printed yet. I would prefer it were printed, but it's not. It's PDF. So that's why I use a program called Notability.
Oh, nice.
Notability is fantastic. I've been using this for several years now. And it's here. I use it on my iPad, and it syncs with my phone and my desktop. It's terrific. I take notes on it. In fact, Camden, I use it for my lectures. When I broadcast PDFs, I don't actually use PowerPoint. I broadcast PDFs via Notability. And it's terrific because I can take notes with my Apple Pencil. I have got to see, there's a fundamental problem with using a Kindle. Yes, there you go. Amen. You've got to take notes, whether it's electronically or if it's physically, you have got to take notes. Because when I take notes, I'm synthesizing, I'm thinking, I'm disagreeing, I'm agreeing.
You're to be an active reader, not a passive reader.
You have got to be an active reader. That is critical to this whole enterprise.
I'm interested to, let's tease this out. I use a program, I'm wondering how these programs are similar and how they might be different. I use a program on my iPad, which I love. I get so many PDFs because of the nature of what we do, and I'm tending to prefer them now just because, especially things that I'm not necessarily going to return to every year or something like that. I use a program called Liquid Text. And it's for the iPad. I wish there was an iPhone version. There isn't. But Liquid Text, it allows me to bring a PDF in, and then it has very strong annotation capabilities and note-taking capabilities. So as long as it's a good PDF and not just a picture, OCR. Right. But if it's just a picture, it's not as helpful. But if it's it's a legit PDF that started, you know, as text, then I can very quickly highlight things with my pencil or with my finger. And then it has the ability either to highlight it in color, but I can also do auto excerpt, and then it pulls it out. Maybe Notability does this too, but it pulls it out as a separate note that I can copy and paste. I can connect to other notes. And then when I'm all done digesting a book, I can export all the exported notes if I want as one Word document. So often if I'm preparing for a podcast interview, I can very quickly read a book or scan a book and highlight the most significant passages. I can take my own notes and annotations along with it. I can draw on it if I want, but then I can export that into a Word doc, and I end up with all these choice quotations in one document that I can take and format. Or if I'm doing research, I can expand and write my own thoughts as I interact with the text. That's one app that's really, really useful, Liquid Text.
That
I think
it's
only
good.
Like $5 or something.
That does sound
Maybe
good.
Maybe it's more for the full version.
Right. So I use Notability for my active documents. These Got are it. The ones that I'm reading right now. There's another app called Papers.
Oh.
Papers, P-A-P-E-R-S, Papers. That's what I use to actually store the PDF. So once I've read and interacted with them, I'm done. I'm going to then take that work and I'm going to save it. That goes into a program called Papers. That works on the desktop. It syncs with the iPad. And I will bring that document up from time to time if I need to. But at that point, I'm done with it. All my active stuff stays in Notability. My older stuff stays and moves to Papers. And it's a tool for storing thousands and thousands of PDFs.
Yeah,
I know there are a bunch of apps. It works for me. It's fine.
Yeah, all this has got, this is why it's fun to talk about these things, because people can try it out themselves and see if it works in the workflow. There's not necessarily a right answer. There are sometimes some answers are better than others, but these aren't value judgments here. We're just talking about what works. Now, I don't want to take too hard of a left turn, but since we're on this point, I wonder if you've ever heard of Zotero for source management.
I have. I don't use it. Okay. I know most of my friends, a lot of my students use it. I don't use it.
It's an open source citation manager. I use that for managing all my citations. It's integrated with Word. I integrate it with Word. So whenever I'm putting a footnote in, I don't ever type out the author and the title and whatnot.
Right.
I go find it in my Zotero library and it links it dynamically. And then it imports all the bibliographic information and formats it according to whatever style guide I've chosen. But the reason I mention that, not only for its very powerful citation management features, which are critical, people really ought to be using a citation manager. If you're doing it by hand, I think that's very bad news. But you can also maybe that's what
I
you
do,
brother.
Hand.
Sorry,
I do it by hand.
But if you can also store the PDFs in Zotero itself, so you can have
that's
your bibliographic entry for a journal article, the PDF of that journal article in there, and then they have certain plugins where it will actually pull your annotations from the PDF out into Zotero as Zotero notes. So there's all sorts of wild things that people sometimes like using.
Yeah, notes. Andy Nicelli, he's a huge Zotero guy.
Yeah.
And I don't he lost like 40,000 references or whatever. I don't know. He emailed me.
You
gotta
keep backups of your database, man.
He did, and it was corrupted. He's a fanatic about all that, but it didn't turn out. I don't know if he ever recovered it, but it was like an insane problem. This was 6 months ago. I didn't have the heart to email him and ask whatever happened to that because I.
Well, now you've told everyone. So
I figure I'd make it worse. I need to reach out.
You didn't
to
have
him.
The heart to ask him, but you had the heart to tell thousands of people
it's terrible.
On the podcast.
It's terrible. Now, hey, let me take another turn here.
Yeah,
and this
go
is
ahead.
The critical piece. So on the teaching side of things, and this is probably more of our listeners would be interested in this. I don't know how many of them are on the writing side, but probably more of them are on the teaching and preaching side of things. And that is when I prepare my lectures or when I prepare a sermon or a conference address or whatever, I write that out. I mean, I'm about as close to a manuscript as you're going to get. And I know it is a ton of work. It really is like reading a book. But here's the thing, and this really is a principle that goes throughout all my work, all my research, all my processes. I hate doing duplicate work.
Oh yeah.
By that I mean I hate working on something I took skimpy notes or I didn't write it out well, and 2 years later I have to do the exact same thing again.
Yep.
In my mind, I have just wasted my life. John Piper would be so mad at me at that point.
Don't waste your life. Yes.
Yeah, don't waste your life. So I work really, really hard at writing out as much as I can of my lectures, of my sermons, of my addresses, because if I do that and I work really hard at that, I can use that material in other places.
Repurpose
in fact,
it.
I've turned two of my lectures. This right here from Adam and Israel. These are my notes for my biblical theology class that I teach. This right here, this guy.
Yeah, the story retold.
My New Testament introduction notes. And I just wrote them out because I worked hard. It took me a long time to do it. And that's why most people don't want to do it because it really is a hard thing.
We don't treat our future selves very well. We do whatever's easiest in the moment.
Yes,
you're just trying
that's
to
a great way to
reach,
say it.
Reach a minimum bar and say, I just got to get this done. I can just take notes. I know it in my mind. And when I preach this, I'll be fine tomorrow. I'll remember. But if we spend the time doing the work up front, then we're ending up putting ourselves in a place where we can reuse that material. I love what you're saying.
That's just a principle that I live by. I work hard once. And if you do that, you do that, then you can keep going back and you can refine things.
Yeah.
That's really words to live by. The other thing is find my Bible here. Here it is. So I don't know how you are. So my lecture notes, a lot of them are on Keynote. So I use Keynote and then I convert them into PDF.
Yeah.
When I actually present them in class or if I'm doing a conference, I present it. So I most of the time I don't have my lecture notes in front of me. What I have is my Bible and I have my iPad and I can see obviously the slide that I'm talking about.
Sure.
But I spend a lot of time on taking my notes and putting them into my overhead. So they're actually pretty thorough pretty thorough overheads. And then the other thing that I do, I know there are a lot of people don't like to write in their Bibles, but I write all throughout. Yeah. On every page, really on every page, I have my lecture notes. This is funny. These are my lecture notes through the years in all my classes. So I have all my lecture notes in my Bible, and I keep them on the overhead. And that allows me to engage the students better, so I'm not reading as much. So it's here with me. I found that if I have to teach Sunday school, that, hey, I already have my notes in my Bible. I've got it. I'm ready to go.
Just don't lose that Bible. Then you're set.
Yeah. So I have a second copy. I have an identical copy of this Bible.
Yeah.
I have two of these.
Oh, nice.
I started to make a backup. I bet you got to do it by hand. I got to Genesis 3. I got to Genesis 3 and I gave up. It was like the fall. The fall broke me again. It's too many notes.
That's pretty wild. I was just suggesting getting a book scanner because we've got one of those in the office. I've thought of that.
But you're talking, this thing is massive. This is massive.
Yeah, it's faster than
it's not just a couple hundred pages here. I've created a problem.
No, the solution is the magic words for professors: research assistant.
Right. I've thought of that too. I have actually thought of getting my TA to do this.
Teaching assistant.
To just have him scan it and then to create a backup in case I lose it. So
I like what you're saying.
Let me show you some other things that I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. I'll first use something called, have you ever heard of mind mapping?
Oh yeah.
You know mind map?
Yeah.
I'm not a devotee.
I appreciate it. I've done it. It's always been helpful when I've done it, but I'm not a zealot. I'm not opposed to becoming one. I'm just saying it hasn't gripped me.
Okay. So it can be really good when you need it. In other words, I don't do it with everything. I think that's right.
Some people tend to that's what I meant. Some people just jump in and try to make a mind map of everything. And then it's like having a hammer. And when you have a hammer, all you have is a hammer. Everything's a nail.
Right. So I am a visual learner, and I like to use graphics in how I learn. And as I'm writing a commentary on Mark's gospel, I'm in chapter 2 now. And so one of the things that's difficult, especially in gospel studies, but the same would go for Paul and these other books in the New Testament, is to just get the big blocks of how things are working, how things are moving. And in the gospels, Jesus goes from one thing, we go from one thing to the next. And so it's hard to figure out how are all these parts fitting together. And mind mapping is an amazing way to, so here I have Matthew teaching discourses, right? So there are five of them. And so I'm trying to figure out how do they flow together? How are they interacting with each other? Or here are the seven signs of Mark's gospel or of John's gospel. And I try to piece them together. Here I have, this is in Luke's gospel, the parables on the journey when he's journeying from Galilee to Jerusalem. This right here is a free tool. It's called Simple Mind. I don't know if I'm using that ironically
forget about me. Yeah.
it's called Simple Mind. It is free. It's a free desktop. Their iPad one, I think, is paid, so I don't use that. But I don't really care to use it on my iPad. I just use it on my desktop. I thoroughly enjoy this. I have been able to kind of wrap my head around some difficult pieces simply because I've mapped them out graphically. And I'm not a zealot, but I think that there's a time and a place for this, and I believe more people would really enjoy it.
I think that is the perfect use case for mind mapping. Sometimes, students would benefit greatly when they're thinking maybe like in an OTI or a new Old Testament introduction or New Testament introduction class where you're thinking about, or even church history, like big big figures, you know, who was
big figures, right?
Who was Vreda or something, or Note,
right?
And then just putting him out there and putting the idea, maybe connecting it to people he was reacting to. But for biblical theology and big picture textual analysis, this is
terrific.
Really handy, and it helps you to see how the portions connect to one another.
You know, Cannon, let me just inject something here. So you have to think about how learning has unfolded the last couple of decades. Because so my professors, I have some of the best professors in the evangelical world. Mm-hmm. They were not trained, nor did they know how to use accordance well and logos well. Like, that was sort of when I was a student, accordance and logos, and back then we had Bible Works. Those were just sort of starting to hit the market. Do you see?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my professors, they just use the old school concordance to figure this out. They use hard copies to do what we do in an instant. This is my point. Nobody is teaching students, or few people are actually teaching students how to do good exegesis using, and we haven't talked about accordance and logos yet, but these types of tools.
Yes. Yes.
The idea is that we just let students figure these things out on their own. And then we're not that professors are opposed to it. It's just that they don't really know how to instruct with it,
mm-hmm.
or how to use it well. And so there really is this huge lacuna in the classroom. But in other words, students learn one thing in the classroom, and then when they leave the classroom, they go and do something else.
Yep.
Do you see? There's a breakdown.
There's an importance there too, I think, for professors to be versed in this stuff to some degree. They can't be experts on everything.
No, they can't.
And just by nature, they're going to have their way, and students are sometimes going to be more on the cutting edge of technology just for generational reasons. However, if there's never any dialogue between the two sides, teacher and student, then students might be appropriating tools or techniques and not being critical about the epistemological or pedagogical effects of those tools. So it's important also to use tools that can help us. It's always good to be doing those things. But like, in many ways, the book, the Codex, is an incredible step up or an advancement over the scroll. But also something is lost with a codex versus a scroll. We lose the emphasis, just the built-in emphasis on the on the narrative moving from one to the other, because you can hop around a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Hopping around is a benefit, but it also, if you're not wary of it, you might end up losing something in the process. Same thing with technology, you know, looking something up, running a query, or right-clicking a word and finding out what, you know, how to parse it just at the touch of a fingertip is really handy and useful, but it's not a substitute for knowing the grammar in the first place. That might be an extreme example, but the technology can often bring great benefit, but without understanding what it's doing, we lose sight of the effects it might be having on us. It's kind of a Neil Postman lesson, I think. There's this whole section in Amusing Ourselves to Death of the epistemological effects of the wristwatch, which sounds like the most ridiculous thing. But once everyone had the time on their wrist, it changed the world.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes for better, but also for worse, because everyone became rigid and you weren't measuring your day based on rhythms. You were measuring it based on a machine. Yeah.
Right. On a machine. That's exactly right. I think that's a very good point. Another thing. So let me show you a couple things here on accordance. I think that's important. So this is accordance. It's your basic text. These are just a couple things that if students and teachers and preachers could do them well, it would revolutionize their study. And one is just simply looking at cross references well.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my English. Let's switch over here to Holman. So let's do Holman here. Here's my text over here. Are all my cross references? Now the thing is about cross references is that they're not very well laid out. We don't know They don't tell you which one's a quotation, which one is an allusion, and which one's a concept. And, you know, it's kind of a tricky thing. But if pastors and students and teachers and everybody else, lay people, if they could just learn how to read the Bible like this, it would really fundamentally change their view of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So you see, the reason why we need all these things is because we don't know the Bible well.
Mm-hmm.
If we really, really studied it hard and learned it and really meditated on it, we wouldn't need these things. But mm-hmm. because we're addicted to our wristwatches, as you just mentioned, as you just pointed out, because we're governed by the Apple Watch.
Yeah, right.
We really need these things. And it what's nice about doing electronically is it saves you gobs of time, because you could just put your thing on.
Oh, sure.
And it shows you, these sorts of things immediately. See, and you don't even need to know Greek and Hebrew, and you can use, there are free sources online, a Gateway Bible, these sorts mm-hmm. of Blue Bible, these sorts of things, free cross references. There's really no excuse to not use cross references. It really is one of the main tools that we can
use.
Yeah,
so basic. But yeah, it is so basic they might not even think about it or check them.
Right. It's so basic. Another one here. And then here's my Logos. I'll show you my Logos.
So what are you doing when you're in here studying a passage and you're just, if you're going to take notes on something, you're just writing it by hand? You copy
and
paste it?
So let me show you. Right. I will show you exactly what I do. I believe I can share my whole screen. Let me see here. Make sure I get it all ready. That's a good question. I'll do here. Then I'll do entire screen. Yeah. Okay.
Look at that.
All right. So you can now see it's. No, you see
yeah.
Yourself.
Now we're going to
now
the rabbit
good.
Hole. The video inside of a video inside of
I know.
A video.
Man, we're being very philosophical.
Very Lewis Carroll.
All right. Can you see that?
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Okay. So
you have a Word document for the people listening. Yeah. We have on the left side, left half of Ben's screen is a coordinates, and on the right half is a Word document.
Right. So I was working on this yesterday. This is an amazing, amazing text. I'm here in Mark 2. I was working on verse 12 yesterday. This is when Jesus heals the paralytic. And so I've been working on this for a little bit. This is what I do. I look at the text, I do searches, I check things, and then I go right into writing.
Sure.
There is not a middle step here.
It's all writing, but taking notes is a form of writing too, but what you're saying is it's going into what will eventually be shaped into the final document.
Yes.
You're not
I will go right in. And you know, that's the thing, Camden, is that, I mean, I've been doing this for, I mean, I guess started my dissertation in 2004.
Yeah.
So it
works.
Almost 20 years. But so the more you do this, the less you need to take notes, because you realize what you need to say.
Right.
And I think for younger students, they're just they don't know what they need to say at that moment.
Sure.
But once you get kind of down, And you have gray hair, then you realize,
or no hair.
I know when I need to talk about it. Or no hair at all.
Yeah, there you go.
You realize, right. I know when I need to say, and I know what I don't need to say.
Yeah. So you're doing a lot more editing in your head. I mean,
so you do more editing. You're exactly right. You're doing it more in your head.
Well, I think that's just a demonstration of the fact that you're developing and growing in your thinking. You're thinking more clearly. And, you know, a student, an undergraduate, you know, to use a phrase that one of my former professor or seminary professor said, they'll just vomit onto their screen. You know, they just throw whatever. And then we'll fix it later. But back when we were using typewriters, I wrote a couple papers in junior high on a typewriter of all things.
Oh, wow.
My family didn't have a nice computer, but, and then even before that, you know, with a quill or something, a dip pen, you'd have to sit and think about what you were going to write. So I think you've just accelerated that process. Let me share a word of warning to our listeners and viewers just briefly, because we've had a bit in the last few years, a rash of these plagiarism charges. You know, various people have been at least accused of plagiarizing. I don't think the folks that have been accused have done it intentionally, but I suspect that people make an error in this process from researching to writing. I'm guessing, based on the nature of these verbatim, you know, accusations of verbatim plagiarism, I suspect some people have probably been taking notes and wrote down a quotation or a section from whatever they're reading, put it into their document, and then either formatting got messed up later on, or they didn't document their source in the Word document. They kind of knew, hey, this is a quotation from such and such commentary. But then after years of working on this Word doc, they probably, this is my best interpretation, they might have forgotten that that was actually something they copied and pasted rather than something that they wrote themselves. So what do you do in the process when you're writing if you actually want to use a direct quotation? Do you take any measures to make sure that that is separated from the rest of the text? Do you indent it right away? Do you change the color? Do you do anything with a footnote?
That is a terrific question, and this is a huge problem. I try to tell my students how to do this the right way. Notice, let's go back to my screen here. Let me try to share this thing. I'm gonna show you two screens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Do you see what I'm doing here? I'm looking at the text. I'm looking at my cross references. And here's my textual apparatus. Like, I'm primarily working with the text itself, and then I'm making comments on it. I'm trying to explain how the text is built. That's what I do primarily. 70% of the time, I'm just putting it together. Once I have finished my exegesis, my work, then I'm going to move into a different direction. And that's precisely where I think Logos is great. And I'll show you now how I use a Logos. Okay, so now you see Logos here?
Yes.
Okay. So here's my text on the left, and on the right, I've got all my commentaries kind of lined up, right? I got NRGTC, Anchor Bible, that's the ICC, NAC, IVP. So I start to see what other people are saying on my text. Do you see? But I first do my work.
Right.
And then I just kind of peer at these other commentaries to see, oh, I wonder what this guy thinks, what this lady thinks.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I don't. Students do the opposite, okay? Right. Students start, it's ironic, right? So students start with looking at commentaries, and then they kind of glance at the text, and they start to put the pieces together, and they start to write their notes. But here's the thing, it's not text-driven. It's commentary-driven. It's secondary literature-driven. And this is one of the reasons why we have seen so much plagiarism, because, and these are good guys, these are good scholars that make these mistakes, and they just get in a hurry, is that they're not, their work is not text driven. They are spending more time in commentaries than in the actual text. This would not happen if they spent the bulk of their time in the text, because it's their thoughts, because they'd be generating their own thoughts. In fact, I could even divide commentators into two categories. The commentators that say what all the other commentators say.
That's true. Yes.
Or the commentators that say what the text says. Now, of course, I'm being general here.
Yeah. General. There are two different modes. You're right. I notice it myself.
And we can see that, where it's like a lot of these commentaries, like, I just won't buy it because I'm like, oh, it's just going to be all just synthesis. Like all the other commentaries.
Yeah. Right.
So do you see, like, we really are at a fundamental difference in how we work. We really need, the exegete really needs to spend most of his or her time in the text. And then you check that text, then you check your interpretation against others. If you do that, I think you'll be good. I've had this discussion. You know what? I'll tell you what. I I edit a lot of books. I write a decent amount. And the big P word is a scary word for me. It's scary. I mean,
And
I'm
it
sure
has,
that there
people
are
don't realize,
times
it has nothing to do with intent. It has nothing to do
nothing.
with intent. It's
It's a
just,
hard thing.
you can plagiarize yourself. At least when I went to seminary, the honor code there, I wasn't even allowed to just quote, to take something I did in another class directly and then just repurpose it without any notation or reference. You know, that would have been self-plagiarism, and that was possible according to
Right.
that honor code.
Right.
But regardless, whether you're interacting with a quotation or not, no matter what mode you're in terms of just being a commentator on other commentaries, in my case, there's often times where, you know, in historical theology or systematic theology, I'm going to want to include a choice paragraph or something and then perhaps interact with that text. If I am ever copying or typing out somebody else's words, oh my goodness, I take so many steps to make sure that that
Right.
is marked, that I will never forget
For
that
you.
that isn't my own writing. So I will instantly, in Word, when I'm writing, I use styles rather than formatting things directly. I format through the styles, so I'll instantly create either list paragraph, or if I create a new style for a block quote, I'll apply that style right away, so it's automatically indented. I will add the footnote at the end of that with the proper citation, page number reference to where I got it. If I'm not in Word where I can use styles and footnotes, then I will go extra lengths in other ways, in other apps or something. I might change the color, you know, put a gray background on it or something, or I'll put a bunch of hash marks above it and below it, you know, and you know, whatever. Like, I never want to get,
Emojis, caution emojis.
man, exactly,
Let me
exactly.
ask you this. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. What about plagiarism in the pulpit?
Yeah, that's a tough question because people get caught doing the same thing. I would think it's more common and people play fast and loose in a sermon. I don't think, I would never use somebody's verbatim words. There might be a turn of phrase that might accidentally get in there, but I would never use somebody's verbatim words without saying this is a quotation. But it also in a research dot in a research paper, I'm going to document and source things that I'm not even using as quotations. Like if I'm taking someone's idea, I'm certainly going to put a footnote in there or at least reference, acknowledge where this thought came from. And I'll put that often into my sermon manuscript. I use a bulleted note format. It's basically complete sentences. It's not a manuscript proper, but it's effectively a formatted manuscript. That's how I preach off of one of
So
those.
would you
And I'll have
say,
my sources in that document, but I'm not going to
right.
pause every minute when I say something if it's not a full quotation. And if it's more of a passing reference, I'm not going to cite it in speech, even though I'll have it documented in my manuscript. But if I'm heavily using someone's thought, I will certainly acknowledge that orally. Yeah. That's how I
So if
roll.
it's
I think,
something passing,
yeah,
if
like
it's something
if I'm reading
passing.
or if somebody, you know, had a really nice insight or a useful insight, or I was reading a commentary after doing my work and then I realized, oh, well, this is something I missed, and I put that into my sermon. You know, I might mention that point, but
Right.
depending on my dependence or how critical that point was or how much it was original, whatever, I may or may not reference that orally and saying, oh, I, you know, because can you imagine a sermon where somebody, you know, documented every one of their sources? And I'm not talking about verbatim quotes. I'm just
I think we
talking
have seminary students that preach like that.
basically reading footnotes. Like, give me a break. You're losing the
I'm
homiletic emphasis
teasing.
of this. But the reverse, I think, is more often true, where guys are just basically repeating large sections of someone else's work. They're not doing it verbatim, but it's basically thought for thought somebody else's work with no acknowledgement. I think that's wrong, personally.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, I would iterate what I said just a little bit ago. Remember how there are two types of
Yeah.
commentaries?
Two kinds of preaching, right?
Those There are two kinds of
Yeah.
preachers. There are those preachers where you like, that guy just read commentaries this whole week. He barely read the text and he's just preaching what everybody else says. And then there are those pastors when you hear them, and they're actually very insightful in their sermons. Most of the sermons are very good because they're dealing with the text most of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid. And so do you see the plagiarism problem really? Yeah. The latter guys, they don't really have a plagiarism problem because they're in the text most of the week. Mm-hmm. It's the other guys, the former guys,
who
are just they're that's exactly right. They're meditating. It's like Psalm 119 applied to commentaries. It's our right instead of applying Psalm 119 to the scriptures, they're applying Psalm 119 to the commentaries, and that's why they have problems with plagiarism. This is an amazing thing.
I stored up the secondary sources in my heart.
We can have an amazing Babylon Bee would be so good here.
Yeah, they would. It's a tailor-made Babylon Bee.
This is such an amazing conversation. This is a conversation that pastors have really. I think what's hard, and I cannot relate because I'm not a pastor. Hmm. But I know that the older they get, the less energy they have at working on their sermons. Life is difficult. Health problems. Problems in the church. COVID problems, and their sermon preparation gets shorter and shorter. And so what do?
Yeah. It's not, you understand how it happens. It doesn't excuse
you understand.
It.
Right. I understand how it happens.
It should be a cumulative effect. Let's take the perspective of the better world that we were talking about earlier, that you shone a light into this world of doing the hard work up front. Now let's imagine 20 years into pastoral ministry and you've been doing the hard work where you're writing things out, you're thinking hard, you're as you're reading, you're doing good work of writing these things out and not being like me on a Wednesday night or tonight. I might go sit down before dinner and just read some books and just read and then close the book and then go off to dinner. Now, if I'm being better and I'm reading and writing out what I'm thinking, imagine 20 years of that compounded. You know, you have
You'd be amazing.
So instead of burning out, now all of a sudden you have a well to draw upon of your own material. Not stuff that somebody else's, but you've been interacting with a whole bunch of other sources, but what you're documenting and storing up are your own thoughts that you can continue to refine and reuse for Bible studies, books, Sunday school courses, articles, you name it. That's a better way to live. That's a scholarly life, I think.
Right. It's a harder life.
Yeah.
It's a harder life, but it is a life that you will reap an amazing harvest, if not this life, in the life to come. Because remember, and now this is, I'm getting more on the pastoral side of things, but your congregation will only go as high as you let them. If you only preach this high and give them this much, they will only go that high. If you give them this much, I'm putting, for those of you who can't see, I'm putting my hand above my head. If you give them a bounty of meat, if you give them a surplus of the Bible, then how high will they grow? They'll just keep going.
Yes.
So you're really, it's very sad, but you're limiting yourself and you're the limiting people. Others. In fact, you know, Paul warns against this in 1 Corinthians 3. Now, there is probably a little bit more tied to false teaching, but he does say that the pastor, he will be judged based upon his congregation. If he has done a good job, it's in the metaphor of using, it's agricultural and building metaphors. If they have done a good job of in their sermons of shepherding, then they will receive the reward, and that is eternal life.
Yeah.
And so I really think that pastors can apply that very concretely by working hard in the scriptures. That's effective. If you just read through the New Testament, especially in Paul, that's like the most glaring thing, right? Pastors work hard at sound doctrine, work hard at teaching, and are Christian. They are godly.
Absolutely.
You put that together, that is an amazing pastor. That is like bare minimum. And actually, it's sad because that actually is the bare minimum if for a New Testament elder. And so it's just sad that when we see in our own just broadly evangelical, where pastors just they have not lived a life of worthiness. I'm not talking ethically, but I'm talking about in their chair of study, and they don't think that it is worthwhile for them to study and to generate their own material. They think that that is just for ivory tower theologians. That's unfortunate. That is not what the Bible says.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Yeah, this isn't just left for academics or people with a teaching post or people with certain kinds of degrees. This is the basic activity. It doesn't mean every pastor is going to be publishing books per se,
No, of course
but
not.
every pastor is studying. Every single one is called to study and to teach the whole counsel of God. So you want to do that as God has gifted you, and not just be a reporter on what other people have said or taught. Because we have our, you have a unique calling and a giftedness for a particular congregation. You have a place in the body as a living stone. And that, I like to switch metaphors a little bit. We're not interchangeable bricks, but we're living stones, and we each have our own unique shape. As Peter says, God has given a unique measure of his varied grace to each one. And so, to switch metaphors, as I have, we each have a unique shape to fit into one specific spot within the body of Christ. And if we're not inhabiting that spot and pulling our weight and filling the spot, the space with the grace God has given us, then the whole body lacks. And the pastor is called to do these types of things, among others, but to do this specifically. It's
And
been
is not
encouraging.
is and we have the church has more tools, the pastor has more tools now than ever before. I mean, look at all these books that are around me, all these great commentaries, all these great theologians. I can search all these things on my laptop. I can do all these. We can do it in seconds. And it wasn't like this 50 years ago. It wasn't like this even 30 years ago.
I know. Let me ask you one more. This is maybe
It's
a
incredible.
capstone question on that point. And perhaps we can revisit this in a round two or even a round three, and maybe get some of our listeners wrapped up with asking questions or making comments. I'd love to do that sometime. But we have this wealth of information. We have so much around us. We have access to almost anything we want, and the cumulative efforts of saints throughout the ages. How do we protect against just being superficial? How do we just carry on with the type of lifestyle, the studious lifestyle we've already mentioned? Do you have any further thoughts on using all the resources at our fingertips, but going beyond that to something deeper and forging a new path? Because I think there are a lot of books out there where I find them, people have done a lot of research and a lot of books, but basically at the end of the day, it seems as if they have taken all their notes on note cards, and then the product of their research is just putting all the note cards in order and then writing some text to stitch the notes together, you know what I mean? Rather than penetrating to the deeper side of things. And I'm finding it a rarer thing to encounter a deep mind, scholars that are really operating at a deeper level, and they have mastered like what's out there, or at least they're aware of the sources that are out there, but also they're operating at deeper currents, at deeper depths. I wonder how we cultivate that. Is it just, I don't know, is it just reminding ourselves of that, encouraging one another? What would you think?
So I've been sort of thinking, maybe not quite like that, but I've been thinking a lot about that because so I'm 43. I'm mid career. I would like to go, I mean, I would like to be full time all the way through my 60s. Maybe do some kind of set, but I hope I can teach until I die or get dang close to it so I can go in the semi-retirement. Here's my point. Point is, the days are long, but the years are short.
I know.
And it's, and so especially, this is on the academic side of things. Like the amount of books that come off the presses each week, each month. Yeah, I can't keep up with them.
There's no way to.
And that's just books. That's not journal articles. So there is a mountain. There is a mountain of literature out there. And that's just in like one field. There are like multiple fields. There are thousands of scholars that do.
Even
what
if you're
I do.
Just focusing on Romans, you can't read
Even
it
if
all.
You're just doing, you can't digest it. So you really have to make your mind up. What kind of person are you going to be? Are you going to be the person that keeps up with all the journals, that keeps up with all the books? Or are you going to be the guy or girl that spends more time in the Bible and learning the trenches of the Bible, learning the inroads of it? And so I really had to make up my mind years ago saying, I am going to – it's just a weakness of my scholarship is I'm not going to be current. I mean, I'll try to do what I can and I'll interact with the major pieces, but I am not going to spend my days – working through the latest and greatest. I just don't have the time. I have two kids. I've got a house. I've got a wife. I try to do other things besides this. I have hobbies and I just do what I can. And in that time that God has given me, I just want to study the Bible. I want to learn about him. I want to love him and I want to teach that to my students. And if I have the opportunity to write, I'll do what I can there. But really, the main thing that I try to do is to just read slowly and look at the cross references, look at the allusions. So the allusion piece is a unique piece because there are new connections in the Bible, whether Old Testament or New Testament. There are connections there that need more attention, need more time spent on them, and they are exciting. They are amazing. God's people love Scripture. God's people love to see how the Bible is connected. I want to spend my time meditating on those things and explaining them to people. That's the kind of guy that I want to be. So then when I'm 80 years old, you know, I really don't think I'm going to be on my deathbed, hopefully at 80, but if God, I just keep, you know, whatever. Yeah. I really don't want to be on my deathbed going, man, if only I would have read more of N.T. Wright. If only I would have read more of this. No.
Exactly.
I don't think that I will ever regret that, as great as those guys are. I really want to say, you know what? I have spent my life reading and studying and explaining the Bible.
I think that's a great way to do it.
And I think that's a worthy life.
And then when we calibrate, I think we have to be more content with that, that we're not necessarily, if we're leading a deep life, maybe to use a phrase from Cal Newport, he's a computer scientist at Georgetown who writes a ton of books on studying and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Really
I'm
interesting.
I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
So if we're content on that, and our attention is on God's word, we just have to be content that we're not going to be on the cutting edge of a lot of things. But but that's a good thing. I think we need to calibrate our whatever signal threshold, that the most important things will still make their way to us eventually. Like, you know. So what if we didn't read whatever article was just published in some German journal, but if it ends up becoming a real significant piece, you'll end up hearing about it several times from other people anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if you're going to miss out on major shifts or major interpretive strands down the road. You might be a little bit late to the party, but it's not as if focusing on the word and going deep with your own thoughts and trying to be, you know, focused and original in those regards. That's not the same thing as being an academic hermit or some sort of
right,
like schismatic.
Camden, think about this though. Watch how this comes full circle.
Yeah.
If you live a life that meditates upon Scripture and is enmeshed in his word, you actually will be cutting edge.
Yeah. Oddly enough. Yeah.
Because you will discover things that other people have not, because they have not done that. Do you see? So by kind of taking the slow approach, the difficult approach, you've got to put your time in. I think that's what's hard. You've got to put a couple decades in.
Yeah.
You got to do the work. If you put work in, you will then start to kind of come back and actually be cutting edge, because you will discover things that those have not, who spent more time in journals, more time in journal dictionary articles than actually in the Scriptures. Do you see? Because they are actually seeing
I get it.
So you will actually be cutting edge, just not cutting edge, maybe the way that the world wants it,
du jour, or
the
way academia or whatever. Wants
it.
Yeah.
So
it's a better way to do it. It's just more, there's more integrity to it. It's better for you. It's more God honoring, I think. It's better for the church and your family. So all around, just, I guess the thesis here is use all these tools and techniques, write in, give us other ideas. We'd love to hear about them. Maybe we'll revisit that in a future episode. But at the bottom line is you got to punch the clock.
Right.
And not in some way where you're just biding your time, but you need to be a workman approved, you know, faithful. And to do the hard work, even when we don't feel like doing it. As we do that work, we will eventually reap a harvest.
Right.
It's true for farming, just as it's true for study.
There are times that I don't feel like working. Mm-hmm. There are times when I don't feel like writing or preparing lectures or lecturing. When it's difficult, like when my dad passed away, when we mm-hmm. lost our house, like there's... I would sit down and I would force myself to work and to labor and to study. And that was difficult. I did not want to do it. Mm-hmm. But you've got to work through those things. You've got to work through difficulties. Mm-hmm. Even though life kind of gets in the way of that. And that's really, and I think we need to learn to break through those times. And I think mm-hmm. if you do, then you'll get even more godly.
Yeah, more benefit from it. Hey, benefit amen, brother. Life. Well, I think that's I could talk all day. I'd like to, but I think we ought to wrap this one up here at this point. I'm looking at the clock. We've gone an hour 17 on the live stream so far.
You're loquacious.
I want to thank all of our people for joining in and for this midday live stream. Someday we'll be like PresbyCast and start them at 9 p.m. or something and have a party at night. But the way we roll, a lot of us, we're in bed by then. Those of us who read and write all day long.
Yeah.
But this has been really fun. Ben, give us an update. You just went to the third printing on the story retold. Did I see that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's exciting. I found that out yesterday. I don't know how many number. I think they print in batches of 5,000 or 6,000. So I was excited.
Wow.
Excited about that. God has used that in so many ways.
That's great.
That's fun. I've really been working. I spent the last couple of years working on use of the Old Testament, the New Dictionary with Baker. It's a massive project. It's probably going to push mm-hmm. a million words. And I've worked so hard on that. That's just been a very complicated project. It doesn't come out till next fall, but I think we're almost there. Hmm. And I'm really excited about it. And we'll see what happens.
Keep at it. We've also have the handbook on the Gospels from Adam and Israel to the Church. The series Ben's editing, Essential Studies in Biblical Theology. And that handbook series. So there's all sorts of really wonderful things.
I have a book on Luke's gospel coming out in the fall with Crossway.
Yeah.
In a new series that they're doing.
Oh, great.
And I that's a theology of Luke there. Mm-hmm. So
there's always things to look forward to.
There's always things to, that's the thing about the Bible. You never get tired. I never get tired of talking about the Bible.
Praise God.
If you have me do other things, I get bored.
But the Bible, His mercies
are
new every morning.
It's exciting. It's life giving. All these other things are life sucking, life taking. The Bible's life giving.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Amen. So we'll have links to all these things as well as the various apps we discussed, the books we mentioned. I tried to take studious notes, and when I edit this, I'll make sure that I catch them on the way back. Also, check out the chapter markers on the YouTube video and the MP3 podcast so you can bounce around and share it with your friends. But it's been a real pleasure talking with you, Ben. I want to thank everybody for watching and listening, especially the people on the live stream. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.